Well, my name is Daniel Shu. I'm the Associate Director of the Innovations for Successful Societies project, and I'm here with Mr. Joshua Galefo-Olwe, the CEO of PIPA in Gaborone, Botswana. So thank you very much for taking time out of your very hectic schedule at this particular time of year to meet with me. I do appreciate it very much, and I'm glad to have the opportunity to sit down with you before I leave.
Well, thank you for including me in this program. Indeed, it's a pleasure.
So before we begin with some specific questions I have about your work here, I wonder if you would mind just giving us a very brief introduction to yourself and the career trajectory that has brought you to this point as CEO of PIPA.
Thank you. I trained as an accountant and served my articles with an accounting firm called Deloitte Haskins and Sells, then in their offices in London. And on completion of my articles, I joined a mining company in a town called Silibipikwe in Botswana. It was a mining company owned by Anglo-American Corporation and Amex Inc. out of Greenwich, who were, at the time, one of the main natural resource companies in the United States. After working there for about 13 years, I moved to Gaborone, where I worked as a deputy general manager of the national airline, Air Botswana, at the time, way back in 1993. I was with Air Botswana up to 1999. During my tenure at Air Botswana, I led a team that restructured the airline. So the airline's financial performance turnaround to making a profit for the first time since the airline was established at independence in 1966. Wow. And when I left the airline in 1999, we had 3 years in succession been posting a profit, the maximum being 20 million pula at that time. I joined the privatization agency when we were, because I was a part of a team that looked at the introduction of a privatization policy whilst I was with Air Botswana. And indeed, following the turnaround of Air Botswana's performance, it was to be a pilot project that we would submit for privatization. At that time, I think it was quite, the market was very vibrant for airline privatizations. It was the time when Kenya Airways was privatized, at the time when South African Airways was privatized to Swissair, the transaction that was subsequently reversed. Mm-hmm. But so when the opportunity came to join the privatization agency, I felt that with my understanding of how the private sector operated, with my understanding of and contribution to the restructuring and turnaround of the financial performance of Air Botswana, I felt that I could make a contribution in other sectors of the economy in bringing about public enterprises reforms. I'm emphasizing public enterprises reforms, but because within the public sector reforms, we have the civil service reforms targeting the mainstream civil service, as in government departments, and the reform of the public enterprise sector, the state-owned enterprises that government owns, which are managed somewhat differently, mm-hmm. and jointly they would constitute public sector reforms. Maybe I should pause at that juncture. Or perhaps let me just add that with my recruitment here, I started the organization from scratch in 2002. Developed and undertook the organizational design, studied a lot of other privatization agencies, which there were many the world over, since privatization was introduced in many of the developing countries as part of a structural adjustment program driven by the Bretton Woods institutions to try and assist governments in improving public service delivery. as well as to curtailing public expenditure, most of which went to propping up and unsuccessful and unprofitable state-owned enterprises. In Botswana, the reform wasn't driven by the Bretton Woods Institution. It was a deliberate effort on the part of government, recognizing that they have done fairly, relatively well since independence, when they inherited a country with minimal known resources at that time, little infrastructure, a vast country, a small population, and largely within the poverty trap in 1966. But during the years, government played a critical role in developing the economy, both from the public service as well as stimulating private sector investment, particularly in the mining industry. And with the flow of diamond revenues in particular, that enabled the government to invest substantial sums of money in infrastructure development, in delivery of public services in the form of health, education, infrastructure, and all and sundry. I think it was largely due to prudent financial management and resource management that the country was able to achieve that much. But notwithstanding the achievements that government realized over time, government felt that the economy was getting to a level where it could no longer be driven by government solely without the involvement of the private sector. It is in this context that with globalization, with the economic borders gradually being removed, government felt that the next level of development can mainly be reached with greater private sector participation in the economy. That's where the concept of privatization in Botswana was born, mainly to complement government's efforts in national development. That's why privatization in Botswana is broadly defined to include all measures and policies of government aimed at strengthening the role of the private sector in the economy rather than solely the sale of state assets. The privatization program, government decided that it would be done on a piecemeal basis, as and when it feels comfortable with privatizing whatever enterprise. It was not driven by the desire to raise revenues. It was not so much driven by the desire to stem out the flow of public funds. It was largely driven by the desire to achieve efficiencies, enhance productivity, and create more competition in the economy so that gradually government can reduce the size of the public sector, create opportunities for private sector investment and entrepreneurship, in the process develop a capital market, ensure citizen economic participation, and create wealth for all. These are the broad strategic objectives for driving the privatization agenda in Botswana. The efforts made by government in moving in this direction has been to try and take everybody on board so that we all see the benefits of promoting private sector participation, bringing about all these other benefits as a result of shifting the developmental focus of government. The model and the focus obviously poses various challenges. The first challenge that emerges from that type of approach was that there was no evident burning platform to want to drive this type of reform agenda. Obviously, up until the recent economic downturn, government was endowed with resources and they were generating a lot of their money from taxes, royalties, dividends from the natural resource sector, generating revenues from tourism and other areas. Until recently, the government had earned substantial foreign reserves, I believe sufficient at some stage, not in the too distant past, sufficient to cover 27 months of imports. But obviously following that economic downturn globally and the decline in the demand for diamonds and as well as prices for diamonds, very little or no revenues have been flowing into the national treasury from the diamond sales. And therefore, government has been relying on the savings it's made over the years. And clearly, it's only now that there seems to be a burning platform for people to want to contain costs, to want to grow other revenue streams, such as the disposal of some of the mature national assets in order to finance new investment in national assets. At the same time, the desire to hive off a lot of the public sector functions to private sector service providers as a way of bringing down the expenditure on the public sector. So there is a now that burning platform that has not been there for a very long time. The other challenge is because reforms were self-imposed, whenever there was a resistance to privatization on account of the perceived potential job losses, a concern often raised by the opposition parties, the labor movement, government would stall and move slowly to take account of some of those concerns. And that has had the effect of dampening the desire to move the privatization program forward at a pace that we think it should have been moved at. So these are some of the challenges of a self-driven structural adjustment program in a middle-income country that has achieved the sort of successes that you made reference to, largely driven by civil service. So at times, success brings in other challenges, which I think in our case, from the privatization perspective, if we were to compare ourselves with what has been achieved in Tanzania, for instance, we could have done more in driving the privatization program. The focus largely for the program has been in those areas where there has been less resistance, particularly in areas relating to the outsourcing of the delivery of public services to private sector service providers, where government contracts out the provision of various services, road maintenance, buildings, construction, building maintenance, refuse collection, catering, and even including outsourcing of some of the core functions in other areas. So looking at outsourcing the delivery, currently evaluating the delivery of healthcare using some of government's facilities. And we find with this model where government retains the responsibility for the delivery of services, but contracts a private party to implement the delivery function. There has been less resistance to that form of privatization. The other focus of our reform agenda has been mainly to restructure state-owned enterprises. The restructuring comes about as a result of our state enterprises fairly functional. They are performing the functions that they were set up to do. Not all of them are loss-making. There are majority are profit-making. It's only when you look at the profits that they make in relation to the investment that has gone into them that you begin to ask yourself, is government getting value for money? And in most instances, it has been felt that I think the returns that are being made are not commensurate with the sort of investment that has been made or that could be made had that the services been provided by a private sector party. So the restructurings have taken the form of reducing the cost structure of these enterprises, improving the performance and delivery, performance from a financial standpoint, performance from the delivery of certain universal service obligations, performance from playing the developmental role as a public enterprise as an instrument of government to prop up a development, provide services in those areas that would otherwise not attract private sector investors. So that has been the focus of the restructuring program. Focus has also been in commercializing some of the government institutional functions, such that some of the functions can be accounted for on a full cost basis, rather than the approach that is typically found in the public service, where one is only looking at the direct costs of provision of services. But in the commercialized environment, one will be looking at the direct and indirect costs. One will be looking at changing the accounting system from a cash accounting system to an accrual accounting system. One would also be looking at setting up some of the big state-owned enterprises in the form of business units, so that you are able to know and fully account for which are the cost drivers, and therefore how could you then bring down the cost structure, how could you improve services by disaggregating the manner in which we account for costs, we account for revenues, we account for service delivery within our public enterprise sector. So the restructuring has played a very critical role. The restructuring has also been in the form of recapitalization of some of the state assets, the state-owned enterprises. State-owned enterprises, because of by their nature, have always been seen to be playing a developmental role. Government initially invests money, and then the growth of that enterprise is largely out of retained earnings, and in some instances, government used to lend money and finance these enterprises through provision of loan finance to the enterprises. There was a public debt service fund that was created. It was a vehicle for lending to state-owned enterprises. And what tended to happen was you would have an enterprise solely financed with debt, especially where the initial equity injection got eroded by the accumulated losses over a period of time. And then you'd end up with an enterprise whose growth, expansion, and sustenance was built on loan financing. Obviously, we all know what happens when you finance a business solely with debt financing. The cost of that financing, which is the interest, tends to outstrip the revenues, and in some instances leave very little of retained earnings to plow back into the business. So the financing structure of some of the enterprises was not commensurate with modern business practice, and therefore a good number of them had to be restructured by through the conversion of debt into equity, so that you had the right appropriate mix of debt equity financing characteristic of certain industries, which would ensure the viability and sustenance of that particular state-owned enterprise. Mm-hmm. On the divestiture front, the sale of state assets, I think that's an area where we don't have much to show for our efforts. It certainly is not out of lack of trying. It's just out of, I think, the environment, as I've described it, driven by a government that is comfortable with doing whatever it has been doing and doing it well or relatively well. A government that is fairly sensitive to public opinion, especially where people perceive privatization to be a way of selling the family silver. And in most instances, given the level of awareness in the country and the means of the financial means of those that can afford, the view has been that privatization would only benefit foreigners and not the citizens. For that reason, government has been loath to push through certain transactions. We advised on how Botswana should be privatized in 2007 to get a strategic equity partner who would also have a management contract to run the airline and grow and get the small Air Botswana to fit into the broader regional airline network and therefore expand the reach, make frequent flyer programs viable, allow the airline access to global distribution systems, and all of that. Government decided at the end of the transaction not to proceed with it because it was perceived that a South African carrier or carrier operating out of South Africa at a stage where the promotion of tourism within the SADC region has received critical focus, that it may not be in the best interest of promoting tourism in Botswana that an airline could be put into private sector hands, especially if the investor and strategic equity partner was an airline from outside the country. So government decided not to proceed with the transaction, not because there was no business case that could be made to justify the privatization, not because there was no investor interest to warrant a conclusion of that transaction, but for various political as well as perceived strategic interests of government viewed from the perspective of tourism promotion, that government decided they would not privatize at this stage, but would restructure the airline further to ready it for eventual privatization in the future. Now, in the case of the Botswana Telecommunications Corporation, where again a lot of work has been done to privatize BTC, government as a run up to the elections has decided that they would not drive the transaction according to the program that was agreed largely on account of, again, the unstable financial markets. So the government has decided that they will need to see an upturn in the global economy, and only then would it move forward to privatize BTC. The same applies to the work that we're currently doing to privatize the National Development Bank. So on the divestiture front, work has been done. Decisions have not been forthcoming at the time expected, or the type of decisions that were expected to at least test the market and put one or two transactions in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. But we think not in the too distant future. Clearly, certainly, I'm sure after, I'm just speculating here, and after the elections in October, I'm sure we will start seeing some transaction flow into the market. The aspect of private sector participation in the economy that has been also that has been driven with some degree of success has been the promotion of private sector investment in public infrastructure. We call it public-private partnerships. We call it concessioning public infrastructure, but all it means is promoting private sector investment in public infrastructure. The number of successful transactions have been in the marketplace, some including the provision of serviced office accommodation to government by private sector investors, where government pays for the use of the facility over a concession period of some 10 to 15 years. And the financing, development, and maintenance of the property being done by private sector investors. We have a number of two office accommodation projects. We have the second university, the Botswana International University of Science and Technology, which is about to be constructed in a place called Palapi, along the MIT model. But with the campus infrastructure and facilities being financed, developed, managed, and maintained by private sector investors. There is further work in the pipeline to look at other sectors, the rail sector, the toll bridge linking Botswana and Zambia. So on the public-private partnership front, there's been a fair degree of success. We've also developed and got government to agree the PPP policy and implementation framework to facilitate the delivery of public infrastructure through the concessioning model. So that's by way of our experience with privatization. Mm-hmm. The model that had been adopted, again, which is perhaps Botswana specific, I think it was tried in the United Kingdom, did make success in the UK largely because privatization there was largely driven by the Prime Minister's office during the Thatcher days. Mm-hmm. But the implementation of some of these transactions were left in different government departments. I think South Africa did centralize most of the enterprises that would be candidates for restructuring and privatization. They call it restructuring in South Africa, under the Department of Public Enterprises, where these Transnet was moved from the Transport Department, DINEL was moved out of the Defense Department, ESCOM was moved out of Energy, but they were all put under Department of Public Enterprises to ensure that the program is driven from the center, mm-hmm. where there's one authority responsible for driving the program. In Botswana, what was centralized was the provision of advisory support, which largely comes through the Public Enterprises Evaluation and Privatization Agency, PEPA. But once the advice has been tendered to line ministries, the implementation then would reside in line ministries. So if you're privatizing Botswana Telecommunications, it would be the Ministry of Science, Communication Science and Technology that will implement the recommended privatization strategy for BTC. If you're privatizing Botswana Power Corporation, it will be the Ministry of Minerals and Water Resources that will be responsible for implementing the transaction after PEPA and the Ministry of Finance have recommended the transaction structure. So the decentralizing privatization implementation had its own setbacks. The setbacks were largely due to the lack of capacity within line ministries to implement such complex transactions and processes. The people that understood better the issues and the challenges and the transaction structure were those that are advising, and largely advising with the support of various transaction advisors, investment bankers, and specialists in the discipline. But when it came to implementation, it was difficult for the implementing ministries to implement something that, one, either they don't understand fairly well, two, they may not necessarily agree with, three, it may not be one of their major priorities, given a gambit of all other issues that they have to deal with. So up until recently, the beginning of this year, government decided to centralize the implementation of privatization under the Ministry of Finance, under PEPA, so that PEPA would be advising on the privatization strategy. Once cabinet has agreed, then PEPA will be responsible for leading the implementation, of course with the participation and involvement of other client ministries. So we think that through centralization, you can develop capacity and competency within one outfit. And the lessons that can be learned from in one transaction can then go and benefit the next transaction rather than the previous decentralized approach. Let me pause that far and perhaps give you the opportunity to put to me any specific questions that you may have.
Sure, thank you.
Identify.
Now, this has been a very helpful overview of the numerous things that you're involved with. I mean, your mandate seems exceptionally broad, but also it strikes me that you're in quite an unenviable position in many ways, because you're charged with advising and attempting to get the ball rolling on these processes, on the privatization process, but at the same time, the necessary support is perhaps not quite there.
Absolutely.
And one of the things that I was quite interested in is that there does seem to be this perception that a bit of a misperception, rather, about what your exact responsibilities are, because when some of these privatization processes haven't gone through, then it falls at your feet in many ways, which seems a little bit unfair. And at the same time, you have this perception that PEPA is created to sell state assets. So it seems like you have quite a job in terms of just getting across what actually your responsibility and your role are. And I'd be interested to know the types of initiatives and the types of strategies you've tried to adopt to get this idea across of what it is exactly that your responsibilities are.
Okay. I think one of the things, especially after the privatization of Air Botswana didn't go through, some of these things, when they happen, they can be a blessing in disguise, because the client ministry disowned the privatization. The client ministry said, well, it was PEPA that was advising on the privatization. And when PEPA tendered the advice, then the client ministry picked and chose what they wanted to do with the advice that was being tendered. Once we had a portfolio of projects, I think about something like 15 projects, and none of them had been taken any further by the implementing ministries. And we were able to quantify how much resources have been expended on these projects. And fortunately, with, again, some of the reports that were coming out from the visits by the IMF, the visits by Standard & Poor's, the visits by the other sovereign rating firms, it became clear that there was need for policy coordination and policy implementation. And that's when the chickens came home to roost, because it became evident that there was a barrage of advice that had been tendered on a range of projects covering a broad portfolio, but that very little was happening, and it became clear that the decentralization model was partially to blame. And the decision, therefore, to centralize implementation, I think, was a key step. The next initiative that we sought government to approve was to agree to a revision of the privatization master plan. It's a strategy document that spells out what the roles of the different stakeholders are in the privatization process. So that we are going to have a revision of this document on roles, and have this document taken to cabinet so that a presidential directive can be issued which will bind all ministries once it is elevated to that level. A draft cap memo was prepared, it was circulated, ministries made their comments, the comments were incorporated, the document, I think it is, either has gone to cabinet or is about to go to cabinet now, because our minister has been off sick for quite a while. A lot of key policy reforms are awaiting his return. But notwithstanding that the document is work in progress, but the decision by the president in January was to say this is how things are going to be done now. And basically what the document is seeking to do is to regularize, formalize that and see the consultation process through so that at the end of the day all of us would have had an input. So we are continuing to operate under a centralized mandate. And therefore, this initiative to get to tie down nine ministries to ensure compliance, to ensure they come to the party and don't jump in when it's convenient and jump out when it's uncomfortable, I think that's one initiative that we've brought about. It's not 100% a satisfactory intervention. It's a halfway house. The ideal would have been to have passed a legislation governing privatization so that the roles and responsibilities are institutionalized by law, and that some of the enabling interventions, like the conversion of state-owned enterprises from statutory bodies to limited liability companies, could be effected by legislation across the board so as to facilitate the issuance of shares as part of the privatization process. But we recognize that given the run-up to elections, governments generally tend not to have appetite for passing new laws, particularly on controversial subjects like privatization. So we are working on post-elections, putting before government a piece of legislation to drive the privatization program as the desired end state measure.
Now, you mentioned your privatization master plan, and as I understand it, in this document there are 27 units or enterprises that you've identified for that are candidates for privatization. And I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about how you went about identifying the 27, I guess, top candidates for privatization, and a little bit about the criteria that you used.
Yes. I think firstly, as I said, you know, objectives of privatization have to be borne in mind before we look at the process that we went through to select those 27 enterprises. The objectives are to improve efficiency of the state-owned enterprises through bringing about competition and to improve efficiency through bringing about competition and liberalizing the markets. We also are looking at achieving the withdrawal of government's involvement in the delivery of, in the management and financing of some of the activities of these entities, so that government doesn't crowd out private sector opportunities. So we would look at, is this particular function, can it be best performed by the private sector? Is there a specific reason why the public sector should continue to provide the service? So one would look at the readiness of the private sector to have a role to play in that kind of sector. We also were looking at where would private sector want to invest? Where could we easily get entrepreneurs to invest in these activities? And therefore, the attractiveness of the enterprises became relevant, because private sector would not want to invest in something that is not attractive to them. We looked at which enterprises would contribute to the development of the capital markets, and therefore in deciding which entities would need to be privatized, there were two main principal criteria. One was the desirability criteria. Is it desirable to have this particular function performed by the private sector, or to perform by somebody else other than the public sector? Two, is it feasible? That was another criteria, the feasibility of privatizing or outsourcing that particular function. In some instances, we recognized it could be feasible, but it may not be desirable, especially where a particular enterprise is a monopoly, is a utility. It's providing a commercial service, but it's also providing a universal service. And therefore, it may not be feasible, it may be desirable to privatize it, but perhaps after further reform, the reform could be by market liberalization, removing the monopoly power, creating competition, bringing in other competitors, and then privatizing it. Or it could be by way of restructuring it such that you ring fence the those functions that involve the provision of universal service, rural telecommunications, rural water supply, rural electrification. You ring fence it, and you provide it on the basis of a negative tender, where you invite bidders, private sector bidders, to bid to provide that service, and government, either through using license fees, pays private sector service providers for the service that they are providing to those rural areas, because it may not be attractive to a private sector party to come in and then be burdened with provision of rural water supply, as it would dilute their profitability from the provision of services in urban centers. So all of these measures were balanced, and one was to say, how do we balance these often conflicting public sector objectives? As we say, public policies are a double-edged sword. So this test was applied after we had done a detailed due diligence of all these enterprises, looked at the environment in which they operate, the policy, regulatory environment, the financial performance, the markets and competition issues, the environment issues, the legal issues, and then applied this test of desirability and feasibility and arrived at some of the enterprises that can be privatized immediately, because one, it's feasible to privatize them, and two, it's desirable to privatize them. Some of the enterprises that are desirable to privatize, but not immediately feasible to privatize because you need to restructure them, either to bring about competition or to do a balance sheet restructuring, an organizational restructuring, so that later when the private sector party gets involved, they would not focus on commercial objectives and disband and turn away from providing some of the social and developmental objectives. So that was a test. It was applied, and with these organizations were put into various quadrants. We are currently reviewing the status of those organizations. Some of them, we are seeking to elevate them from quadrant B to quadrant A, quadrant B being those that were subject to further reform before they could be privatized. And it's in cases where such reforms and privatization and restructurings have taken place, where we are now saying to client ministries, let's commit to bringing in private sector participation within this time frame. So it's quite a lengthy and quite involving project, because as you can imagine, there's always a lot of resistance and protection that some enterprises often get from their parent ministries.
That actually feeds very well into the next question that I had for you. Now, presumably, as you mentioned, some public enterprises, there's more resistance than others. And I've heard from other people who've had to deal with these types of issues, these types of privatization issues, that there are two schools of thought, maybe. That firstly, you should perhaps start out with the most difficult ones first, and try and get the big ones privatized first. Or do you start out with the smaller, perhaps easier ones, and build up some knowledge, build up, you know, accumulate some experience before attempting to tackle the really big ones that are going to be more challenging? What is your view on, I guess, which one, on the sequencing of privatization efforts?
Well, initially the sequencing was on the basis of which are the easy ones. Let's go for the low-hanging fruits, and let's run with them. Those that don't require major restructuring, those that don't require a lot of legal changes, and we found that in some cases they were profit making, they were not loss making, they were not perceived to be a burden on the state. And the question was, why do you sell the family silver instead of ditching those that are a drain on the public coffers? So it was as if there was some abstraction of value away from government, and the resistance came from that perspective. We also found that there were certain ministries that had problems with some of the state-owned enterprises were loss-making, coming to government for further major capital injection. And the Ministry of Finance would say, well, why should government put money in when the private sector could be putting money in? And we would use our money for development of education, health, and other sectors that may not necessarily be attracted to private sector service providers. And because you are driving the horse to the pond, but you are not going to force it to drink even when you take it there. So we found that even those that, like the air Botswanas of this world, like the BTCs of this world, we found that even after doing all that work, reasons were always found why they should not, somebody should not let go. This experience is not unique in Botswana. We've studied quite a lot of case studies in other jurisdictions. in Zambia and Tanzania to some extent, they started the loss-making ones, and they were burdened. Government said, well, we're not going to put money in. If you don't go the privatization route, we're going to let you collapse. We saw the collapse of Zambia Airways. We've seen a collapse of a number of other state-owned enterprises. And when people realized it was that bad, it's either without a job or maybe with a guaranteed employment under a private sector owner, others started going the privatization route rather than to be completely shut down. In other jurisdictions in the Scandinavian countries, we've seen our successful privatization of profitable enterprises that have been restructured. We've seen it with British Telecom, we've seen it with a number of other enterprises where they are ready for a taking, they've been restructured, they may be complex, but everybody has volunteered to go that route. We have seen a few volunteers that have come our way are the most difficult ones and the most controversial ones. So I think the long and short of it is I think you need government's resolve to privatize state-owned enterprises, the commitment to cause government as a unitary institution to move ahead with the implementation of a program, to cause ministries to volunteer once government has agreed to volunteer their candidate state-owned enterprises. I think that's what you need. You need that resolve. You need that resolve backed by legislation. And I think you will see transaction flow. In the case of the UK, it took a long time. It was trials, hits and misses. But the Thatcher government had that resolve to drive the program. You either were in it or you were out. In South Africa, it blows hot and cold, start and stop, because there's no such overarching legislation. One moment it's the right way to go, let's privatize SAA, then let's take it back. Let's privatize Telkom, was privatized, and so on and so forth. So it happens in many other jurisdictions. I think in our situation, we need that resolve, and we are seeing the resolve come through National Development Plan 10. That's next year, NDP 10, where government says a primary focus amongst others is going to be private sector development, and privatization program is a vehicle that they are going to push to achieve private sector development.
I wonder if I could just pull the conversation back a little bit. Mm. We're always interested to hear from people such as yourself who've had to essentially set up organizations from scratch. As you mentioned, you had to do. One of the things we're interested in is how you go about finding the right people for the jobs, how you adequately staff an organization such as this one. What were the processes or the procedures you used to identify the people that with the capacities that you felt you needed at the time?
It's a very difficult question, and I doubt whether I can say we were that successful in getting it right from the onset. But you know, it's a trial and error type initiative. Firstly, I think our focus was, what is this organization going to be? What's its remit? How best can this remit be achieved? We were an organization that's going to advise on privatization, commercialization, restructuring, private sector participation of all forms and shapes, as well as something that I didn't talk about, mm-hmm. assist government in monitoring the performance of state-owned enterprises and promote good corporate governance within the public enterprise sector. Now, I mean, as you said earlier, it's a mixed bag of broad elements of a broad remit. So we said, well, how are we going to achieve all the different elements of this remit? So we segmented the remit into particular elements. And we said, in this particular element, what will we see if we have actually achieved the goal that this organization has been set up to do? So having identified the desired end state or achievables for each element of the remit, we then said, what is the best way of constituting ourselves in a most efficient and cost-effective manner to achieve those goals under each remit element? We could have said, you know, we will employ engineers, architects, all functional specialties that will allow us to deal with each and every sector of the economy, mm-hmm. ranging from telecommunications, education, health, water, energy, you mention it. We would have ended up with an organization the size of the public service, as inefficient as it was. But we felt that we are an organization that is to promote private sector participation. And some of this expertise could reside in the public service, in the private sector, rather. Mm-hmm. So why don't we use a delivery strategy where we would contract private sector service providers to deliver some of these mandates on our behalf, so that the skills and competencies that we would need would, one, be amongst the many, project management. We will contract private sector service providers to intervene on a particular function, and ours is to spell out what we need, monitor how they go about delivering it, and take the results, take them forward for processing and decision making, and then work with a private sector party to see the implementation through. So we then decided that we will focus, that delivery model will be a consultancy type model where you'll bring in economists, financial specialists, a few technical people, engineers, architects here and there, but by and large, by in expertise, if you want an investment banker, if you want a telco expert, if you want a social policy analyst, if you want governance specialist, so you would bring them for each and every transaction. So we followed that project management approach. So, and you could find economists, you could find accountants, but you would not find investment banking skills in a public sector environment. You need investment banking skills to carry out company valuations, how you structure a sale deal, because investment bankers, they're in the business of selling businesses. So public service has never been in the business of selling businesses. The public service role is to create an enabling environment for business to flourish in our economies. So we then went out into the market, employed, and in employing staff, we were paying particular attention to people coming in from the private sector. The reason being, we did not want to shift people from the public sector into a privatization agency. So the reform of getting public enterprises to start operating on a commercial basis like private sector companies would have otherwise been missed out had we migrated civil servants into a privatization agency. But somewhere along the line, we started getting trying to bring that balance. You're driving an economic reform within a political environment. So you needed somebody some people that understand the political system in which we operate. And we are now caught at crossroads, as it were, with government saying that with the financial squeeze, they want to curtail the use of consultants. But we have not had sufficient number of transactions to have learned and benefited from the earlier successful transactions. So we are challenged, and we're still engaging government to understand that to change the modus operandi of a privatization agency, you just can't change it by the stroke of the pen, because you've got to build that capacity. Government can't afford that expertise that you find resident in private sector companies. We know what the Citibanks and JP Morgans of this world pay their analysts and their deal makers. There's not a single government that can pay those. That's why the World Bank, through the International Finance Corporation, have provided the advisory services arm to allow governments to access specialist investment banking and corporate finance skills in the public sector environment. So what I'm saying is, yes, it's doable too, but at the same time, there are equally a lot of challenges, because contracting private sector service providers comes with a cost. But if one was to try and be penny wise and pound foolish, again, it could come back to haunt us if we were to cut corners and avoid using the specialists, especially in the initial stages of the project, to try and save money, and then you're disposing of assets worth 2 billion, 3 billion. And some of the parties that we're negotiating with in these transactions are shrewd business people, international operators who, even with their equals, always pull smart deals below the noses of their counterparts. And I think that's one of the challenges that we have as a government, to try and strike a balance between containing the costs of service provision, but at the same time not throwing caution to the wind.
Well, I'm very conscious of the demands on your time, and I was wondering if you'd mind if I ask just one final question, seeing as we've addressed a lot of the issues that I came here wanting to find out more about. My final question would be, what are the types of advice that you would offer for people who find themselves in a similar position to the one that you now hold in other countries? What are perhaps the types of things that you wish you knew when you first started this job that you now know?
I think, firstly, one has to have the appetite to learn, and learn on a continuous basis, and learn from the experiences of other countries. Because if you look at privatization, many countries started in the 80s. And a lot of mistakes and successes were made in the 80s and the 90s. Eastern Europe, for instance, and you know, coming in at the tail end of the privatization drive, if one was to call it that, there are lots of lessons that can be of benefit to a program such as ours here in Botswana. And the challenge is that appetite and greed to learn and to inform themselves and to relate whatever has happened elsewhere to our environment here. And not many of us, I suppose, are too keen to apply ourselves to that extent. The other is, I think, the appreciation that privatization cannot be driven in isolation of the desire to transform the economy as a whole. We've been talking about private sector being the engine of growth, partnering with the private sector, and so on and so forth. But I think when you look at what else has been done elsewhere to promote private sector businesses, create an enabling environment, come up with conducive tax rates and create opportunities when we send missions overseas to look for markets for Botswana produce, to look for investment opportunities for investors in Botswana. Very little was done in the early stages. And therefore, to try and think you can promote privatization in isolation of just the general reawakening that government needs to do more to promote doing business in Botswana. That Botswana is competing with many other countries now, which never used to attract FDI. Countries like Angola, DRC, Mozambique, Tanzania, where Botswana used to, because it had a stable political environment, we used to think people will compete, fall head over heels to come and do business here. But now capital is footloose. People are finding other markets where there is now some semblance of calm. I can't remember the expression you use for these countries like Liberia and
fragile states.
Fragile states. You're seeing some of those fragile states get their act together, create that enabling business environment, going out to attract investment, rich in resources. And though the risks might be high, but the returns and the resource base are quite enormous. So there's just suddenly that reawakening in Botswana, which makes it easier to drive and anchor our privatization program on the activities of various other arms of government. The Botswana Enterprise Development Authority, BEDIA, BDCs, and many other agencies of government, International Financial Services Center, they're all out driving, doing business in Botswana and showing Botswana to be the right place to do business. Mm-hmm. And therefore, privatization in this setting finds allies, and therefore it's easier to sell privatization. Had we realized this earlier, we would have realized that we were too early coming in without allies, and we were going to meet the sort of resistance that we've come across. We also have found the involvement of government's cooperating partners very useful in leveraging our agenda. The sovereign rating companies, the World Bank, recently they came here on a mission to provide funding to government, the African Development Bank. So the Canadian CEDA, Public Private Infrastructure Advisory Facility, all of these organizations have recently played a role, a very critical role, either in financing studies that showed that there was need for policy reforms in the PPP, on PPPs, policy reforms and even financing the drafting of legislation on privatization. So suddenly the whole privatization agenda has been driven by other parties who are coming in as our endorsers and therefore giving legitimacy to the agenda that we've been trying to push single-handedly. I think one of my advice is to drive such a reform, one needs a very strong champion. And if you haven't got that champion, you know you have an uphill battle. If you don't have a champion, but at least have legislation, because you're dealing with reforming organizations that are formed under specific legislation. And when the chips are down, they will hide behind legislation to stall the entire reform agenda. We all don't like reforms. You're pushing people out of the comfort zones, and we all fear the fear of the unknown. So I think these are some of the lessons that one has learned. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I think some of the experiences that we've realized is if you can demonstrate that you've researched your subject, you are coherent and you're credible, I think it goes a long way in selling getting audience from so many other resisting parties. I think that has been a plus for this organization. The other plus is a diverse teacher, same as public procurement. There are two of the very sensitive functions prone to all sorts of, for lack of a better word, should I say, impropriety. And if you can demonstrate that you want to hold the organization as credible as it can be, all above board, follow procedure to the letter, follow the principles of transparency to absolute minimum, absolute maximum, then I think as the agents of resistance take different forms and shapes to run down the process, run down the institution, run down the individual, I think that is some armor that you could use to protect the agenda of privatization, to protect the individual, to protect the institution. And I think that's something that I would say, if the public were to impute any form of impropriety in the disposal of an asset, that will then give grounds for resistance to privatization. And therefore, everything needs to be done to guard against giving privatization detractors any reason to resist privatization.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much. I think that's excellent advice to close on, and I do appreciate you giving me so much of your time this afternoon.
Thank you very much. It's been a very interesting interview.